And tonight on Coast to Coast, we talk about the Archons in ancient history. One of the classics, John Lash joins us. One of his books, Not in His Image, the other, The Seeker's Handbook. Back with John in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Lash is a mythologist, an author, visionary teacher. Now, he's known for his unique approach to the baffling question of our purpose, regarded by many as the direct heir of Joseph Campbell. John puts into practice the creative mythology that Campbell theoretically tried but didn't, in fact, achieve. And what he calls directive mythology, John presents techniques and guidelines for harnessing the power of myth so that it directs your imagination toward the very sources of life itself. Stand by. Here's John Lash on Coast to Coast, live from Belgium. John, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, George. Good to be on the program again.
It's been a long, long time. What have you been up to?
Oh, I've had quite a few adventures since last we talked. It's an adventurous time for us on the planet here.
Yeah, it really is. And I trust the adventures have taken you to many far-out places?
Well, all my adventures lead me back really to the same place, to the same focus, which for me is the living Earth itself. You know, what some people would call, in mythological terms, George, you know, old-fashioned as it may be, the goddess, the mother goddess, you know,
yes,
our Mother Earth. And I find that in my life and my investigations and my mystical experiments, if you will, that they all lead me into a deeper intimacy with the living reality of the planet. So that's what my adventures do for me.
You know, I've always thought that the planet, John, is alive, an organism all by itself. Am I off or am I pretty close?
Well, you know, that is not exactly such a wild view. In fact, if you look back in human history, not too long ago, if you go back before, say, the Age of the Enlightenment, you know, around 1650, the Western period of the Enlightenment, you'll find that the view of the world that prevailed almost everywhere was animism. That is to say that people in all countries, in all cultures, naturally saw the world, the planet, as animated, that is to say, alive. Now, we've come back to that conception now. It was kind of destroyed and threatened by the rise of materialistic science. You know, because materialistic science would say, well, the Earth is inert, matter is dead, matter is not intelligent, you cannot communicate with the Earth. And with the so-called Gaia hypothesis, and you know what that is for sure, mm-hmm, we're kind of returning to this notion of an animated planet, a superorganism.
I believe that, too. And a lot of people are beginning to become more and more aware of it, too, aren't they?
They certainly are, and what's wonderful about it is it's not merely a belief. Animism, as I said in my book, Not in His Image, is not the belief that nature is alive and animated, but it is the direct perception.
Well, that's a good point. And how's the reception been to this new work?
Well, you know, Not in His Image is a challenging book. It's a really, you as yourself, as a trailblazer in many areas of information and knowledge, would understand that a truly original and trailblazing idea often meets considerable resistance, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does.
What is it they say, the three stages of truth? First, it's ridiculed, and then it's argued, and finally it's accepted as obvious or something like that?
And hopefully sooner than later, right?
Yeah, because time is running out for the species. No, my book is building. It's building. And it's holding very well in sales, and it's building interest. And I can say that over here in Europe, it's come out in French. It's coming out soon in Spanish. And just about in mid-February, it came out in Italian, actually.
When we talked 4 years ago, were you in Belgium then?
Well, I think I was here because I have a landline here. And I visit frequently Belgium. I don't always live here. I actually travel around Europe quite a bit. Yeah,
Okay.
I was speaking from the same phone. That's right.
Okay. All right. Very good. You know, we're going through an intense awakening right now that a lot of people were confused during the Mayan calendar date and December 21st, 2012. And, you know, a lot of people thought it was going to be the end of the planet. You know, and I had said, no, I think it's going to be just the beginning of something new and enlightening. Though I did say I believe that the sun was going to do something in terms of a solar flare of some type, and I still believe that could happen. But was it a disappointment to you, or did you expect the way things unfolded?
Well, it wasn't a disappointment for me at all, George, and I'll tell you why. Because I've studied that subject of 2012 and the Mayan calendar and the Egyptian and Hindu calendars, as you know, all my life. I'm considered by some people to be rather accomplished in the knowledge in that area, you know. So, of course, my attention was drawn to the meme of the December 21st, 2012 event. But I have to say that I view the moment that we're living in now more as a window of opportunity. It wouldn't have to be focused on a particular moment when suddenly everything miraculously changes. So I'm certain that the people who were expecting an event of that kind, of a sudden miraculous change or of massive and devastating earth changes, well, they had to be disappointed, didn't they?
Yeah.
So in a certain respect, 2012 was a bit of a setup, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you have to be careful about those kind of predictions because they will almost inevitably produce disillusionment and demoralization. But on the other hand, if you change the concept or tweak the concept a little and say, well, humanity is looking at a window of opportunity, then we can say, well, we're still in that window of opportunity, and what exactly can be done, what exactly can be realized at that moment.
John, the planet seems to be going through some kind of flux right now. I mean, what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in different regions, there's a feeling of people being uptight here in the United States. We just had the story that I'm sure you're aware of the NSA spying on everybody. Something's going on here. I haven't been able to put my finger on it. How about you?
Well, I look at that very closely, you know, as many of us do these days. We keep hearing this term, waking up, okay? We were told, for instance, that humanity was going to wake up at the 2012 event and so forth. Now you're saying, well, it's the Earth waking up in some way. I'll tell you how I see that. I'd like to use an analogy. Let's say that you and I are not separated by thousands of miles, but we're sitting together in a room physically having this conversation. I wish we could. It would be more enjoyable.
Well, we got to do that if you ever get to L.A.
If I ever get to L.A., right. I escaped from L.A. a long time ago. I don't know if I'm going to be back. But anyway, George, let's suppose we're sitting in the same room together comfortably in lounge chairs. We're having this chat. And over on the other side of the room, there's a huge Bengal tiger, okay?
All right, I'm with you.
Sleeping. A Bengal tiger is sleeping. Now, all of us who have animals, especially cats and cat lovers like me, know that animals appear to dream, don't they?
Yes, they do.
So you can see dogs and cats, like, well, you see they're kind of twitching, right?
Yeah.
They're twitching, they can make little yelping sounds, and we think, well, I think, you know, my cat is probably dreaming, you know? So you can tell when an animal's dreaming. So suppose that you and I are in the room with an enormous, humongous Bengal tiger, which is a dangerous animal, when it wakes up. And it's twitching. Its body is twitching. We can see it. It's maybe panting, and it's making little sounds. And we look over, and I say to you, hey, George, I think this Bengal tiger might be waking up. Well, that's what's happening with the Earth, you see. The Earth is alive. It's like a Bengal tiger. It's an animal. It's an animated planet entity. And it's my conclusion over a long life of study that the earth animal mother is waking up. And that is one of the things that accounts for the massive disturbances we see in the atmosphere, you know, and in the geological processes of the earth, such as the salt domes collapsing, the sinkholes, the massive smokers under the earth, the subterranean volcanic activity. All of this is an indication that the planetary animal mother is waking up. And the question is, what's going to happen? What is this wake-up process involve? And how can we relate to it? You know, is it a threat to human existence? Or is it an opportunity for us to connect with the earth in a way that we maybe lost a long, long time ago? I'm thinking along those lines.
Well, and it may very well be the opportunity. Now may be the time for all of this to kind of click. And I hope it does. You have introduced the term, you did some time ago, archons. And are we talking about gods or rulers? What was your definition?
Well, I'm really glad you asked this question, you know, because I do take credit for that. You know, I did introduce the word archon into the global conversation 10 or maybe even 12 years ago.
Right.
And since then, as you know, this word has become used massively by many, many people. But you see, you asked me what my definition of the archon is. Well, I don't have one, George. The way that I defined archon from the moment I introduced it was not according to my definition. That is to say, not according to some idiosyncratic notion that I might have. But it was a definition true to the ancient source materials where that word is found. And what concerns me today, I mean, in a way I'm pleased that millions and millions of people are using this word archon, because it can be a tool of knowledge of singular importance. But I'm concerned that people use it in a reckless way, and they use it carelessly because they don't refer back to the original sources of its definition.
Well, and that definition, I think, is probably critical. I mean, even David Icke is using it now, isn't it?
Yes, I know. David Icke starts using it. The definition is very critical because this is special intel. I call it mystery intel. You can put a capital M on mystery, because mystery, or mysteries, the plural, refers to the ancient sources of that term. I found that term in certain writings that remain, which are derived from the so-called mysteries of the pre-Christian world and the pagan world going back, well, at least 1600 years ago, and then with a long, long tradition before that. Now, in these mysteries, which were organizations of spiritual education, experiment, and training, hence they're sometimes called the mystery schools,
right.
You know, they had, the teachers of those schools had a very particular fix on this archon thing, this archon entity. And I can tell you that they defined it in three ways. There was a threefold definition, and this definition is not mine. This comes directly from the source materials.
And what are they?
Well, in the first place, they did explicitly, as you know, define it as an extraterrestrial predatory entity.
That's right.
You know that. And that is commonly the way the word is used today, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. Sure would. And you know what? They might be right on that one.
Well, these writings, these source materials from the mysteries, which I'm citing, which are in Greek and Coptic language, actually profile these archons as ET predators very, very vividly. And as I've said before, I think we covered this in the first interview I did with you. They described, the ancient sources described, that there are two primary types of this archon predator. There is the embryonic or neonate type. Imagine a prematurely born fetus mm-hmm. that has a large head and spindly limbs. Well, of course, this is a description of the gray ET.
That's right.
Of Whitley Strieber. And they included in the profile a second type, which is a more vicious and aggressive type that may be considered to be the overlord of the gray ETs, who are kind of like drones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that type is the Draconic, D-R-A-K-O-N-I-C, or reptilian type. So it's pretty amazing, I think, that we find the profile of the gray ET and the reptilian types in this ancient material. So that's just one aspect of the definition of Archon. It gets even better. It gets better than that.
Don't hold back.
The second thing that can be learned from these ancient sources was that the seers and the shamans of the mysteries, who call themselves teleste, meaning we who are aimed, we who have a purpose, we who are aimed, these accomplished shamans looked closely at this Archon entity. They investigated its source, how it appears in the cosmos, how it happens to intrude upon the human species, what is its MO, what's its agenda. And one of the things they determined about this Archons is that they can be called the rulers or authorities because they wish to rule over humanity. They wish to dominate us and enslave us. But there's a subtle nuance here to get at the beginning. They are not our rulers and authorities over us. They wish to be. I mean, you got to get that difference.
Have they tried?
Yes, they have tried. And the ancient seers pointed out how they tried. They pointed out what the Archons have done and the tools that the Archons use to take over human reality on this planet. One of those tools is religious belief systems. They work through religion. And as a matter of fact, one of the startling revelations of these Nag Hammadi materials, and you're familiar with them, of course,
yes.
Many guests on your show have referred to them, including me. One of the startling revelations about these Nag Hammadi materials is that they tell us, they warn us, that the Archons have introduced into the human mind a delusional belief system under the cover of religion, specifically under the cover of Judeo-Christian religion of salvation. So actually what they say is that the Judeo-Christian religion of salvation is a foreign implant in the human mind. It is a virus.
Hmm. Implanted for a specific purpose?
Yes, because through that Judeo-Christian belief system of salvationism, and I'll define in a minute what I mean by that, the humanity can be enslaved by these extraterrestrial powers. Now, which, by the way, we looked at one aspect of the Archons, which is they are actually entities living in the solar system with us, but not entities of the Earth. They don't belong to the Earth. They are extraterrestrial. They can't live on the Earth.
And they're physical?
They intrude upon our world through this mental or ideological virus of religion. I've explained this all in my book, as you know.
Yes, you have. And they're physical as opposed to dimensional, aren't they?
They are physical, but they do not physically inhabit our world. In fact, they are inorganic entities, similar to those described by Carlos Castaneda. And as inorganic entities, they have primarily a composition of mercury and silicon base. And because they are inorganic, like any inorganic material, like iron will rust, metal will rust in the presence of oxygen, right?
Yes.
Oxygen is toxic to these Archon entities. So it is, again, a concern to me that people talk about the Archons. They don't really follow the intel of the mystery schools, and people make the rash claim that the Archons can, like, invade our planet and take it over. They can't. They can't live in the oxygen-rich atmosphere of this planet.
That's good. John, hold on for a sec. We're going to be back more on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, John Lash, with us, not in his image, fascinating about the ancient mystery schools The Archons, more to come on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with John Lash, his latest book, Not in His Image. John, tell me a little bit about this project you're working on, the Gaian Navigational Experiment. What is that?
Well, the Gaian Navigation Experiment is kind of like a project to restore and recreate in a modern form the system of knowledge and mysticism of these ancient mysteries. It's kind of like, in a way, a return or revival of the mysteries. And to center or focus this experiment, the Gaian Navigation Experiment, I focus it on one single idea. You could say this is like a challenge, is to say, could we go back to those ancient mysteries and look at the sources that remain, the textual sources?
Mm-hmm.
Could we then select and focus on the central message of those ancient teachings and bring it forward today and reapply it, but redevelop it, actually, in a new form that suits humanity today? This is the challenge behind the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And by the way, I'd like to mention that anyone who is interested in how that experiment is set up and how it's operating can go to the site called GaiaSpora.org, GaiaSpora.org. That is the teaching site for the Gaian Navigation Experiment. And there's another wonderful site which you probably want to even look at first, sure, which is a Facebook page called Sophia's Correction, SOPHIA:S, correction. And that Facebook page was set up by my team, or my crew as I call them, who are pursuing the Gaian Navigation Experiment with me. And it's a beautiful portal into the various aspects of this experiment.
What would you like to accomplish with the experiment, John?
Oh, that's a really great question. Well, you know, there's a remarkable clue in the ancient wisdom teachings that survive from these mystery schools, a remarkable clue. And you could say that the Gaian Navigation Experiment is, in a way, an attempt to follow out this clue. It really relates very closely to the problem of the Archons we were discussing. In fact, I probably should just go back and pick up one more aspect of the Archon profile in order to answer your question properly. Would it be okay if I do that?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, you'll find something, and I want to ask the people, many people out there who are listening right now, who've heard the use of the word Archon, think about what they've actually heard. Because the one thing that's missing, and this really concerns me, is that when people pick up that word now, they do not refer back to the source material that actually tells you how the Archons originated. So, for instance, you know, it's interesting that David Icke has picked up this word, and certainly millions of people listen to David Icke. But as far as I know, David Icke has not said what the ancient materials tell us about how the Archons came to be in the first place. And this particular piece of intel is the basis of the Gaian Navigation Experiment. It actually posits, or it actually presents a relationship, get this, between the living Earth Mother, the intelligence of Gaia, and the Archons. These two things are very closely related, intimately related.
There's no doubt about that. Now, also,
yeah,
you know the work of Zechariah Sitchin?
Yes, I do.
Does that echo any of this? Because, you know, he's talked about some unfriendly visitors who helped seed us.
That's right. Well, Zechariah Sitchin's work is important in order to, because it's a great exercise in discernment and discrimination for those who want to, A, see who the Archons really are and what they're doing to humanity, and B, well, even more importantly, for those who want to enter into the intelligence of the Earth and to collaborate with the living wisdom of the earth. It's very important to realize that Zechariah Sitchin's message is a message of disinformation. And actually, you could consider that Sitchin told the humanity the lie that the archons want humanity to believe. And that lie is that they are our creators. That is not a lie. The archons did not create us. The Mother Earth, Sophia, created us.
Explain that.
Well, the Gnostic, the materials of the ancient mystery schools have made it very clear that there is a cosmology, there is a planetary cosmology of our planet. And so the same seers and shamans in those mystery schools who informed humanity about the archons also told us about the origin of the human race. And this intel needs to be considered together. You can't break it up into parts. It's an entire set of intel. So what the mystery school seers said, plain and simple, was that the genome of the human race, which they call the Anthropos, was designed in the galactic center. That is to say, in the core of the galaxy in which the Earth and the solar system are now located. And they said that in that core of the galaxy, which they call the Pleroma, there are gods, god beings, which they called aeons. And they said that these aeons, in particular two of them, one who was called Sophia and the other who was called Thelete, actually were like scientists and artists who designed the human genome, the human creature. And then they allowed that genomic plasm to be propagated out in the galactic arms and to arise in different worlds and different planetary systems so that it could develop. And that was their divine experiment, because that's what the gods do. They set up divine experiments, and then they watch how these experiments unfold. Now, I don't know how that particular information comes across to you right now, but I can tell you that in the intelligence community of the ancient mysteries, this was their primary subject of interest.
Were they happy with the end result? Us?
Well, very good question again, George. See, the end result is not yet achieved. You see, what they watched, what the seers watched was, they watched how the human experiment, or the divine experiment in humanity, let's call it that, how it unfolded. And one of the things they observed was that it's already unfolded on a number of planetary systems before this one.
I believe that.
That's not surprising, is it?
No.
Is it surprising to say that we, not only are we not alone in the in this galaxy, hey, let's just talk about this galaxy for a while, okay? Our own backyard, before we go out to other galaxies. Are we alone in this galaxy, which consists of 300 billion stars, many of which can support Earth-like planets? Do you think that we're alone?
Heck no.
Obviously not. And not only that, it's even better. There are other strains of humanity, where they all originate from this primary genomic plasm, but there are other strains of humanity, that is to say, people just like you and me, living on other planets in this galaxy. And so there are a number of variations of the divine experiment with humanity. And what the seers of the ancient mysteries observed was rather alarming. They observed that in nine of the previous versions of humanity that seeded itself in a planetary world, like the Earth, the experiment crashed. It went wrong, badly wrong.
Was it their fault?
It was the fault of the subject of the experiment, of the human creature itself. In other words, the human creature was placed by divine design in an environment in order to realize certain potentials, and it blew it.
Ah.
It blew it.
Was it like taking the apple when you shouldn't? Something like
no,
that?
No, it wasn't that. It was that the human genome developed in these nine different strains, these nine experiments, and in each one of them, humanity turned against its own environment and destroyed its own environment, as we are pretty much doing today. So the I use the term Anthropos 10 for the experiment that we are in today, okay? And the other nine experiments were Anthropos 1 through 9, okay? So Anthropos being the Greek name for humanity, okay?
And these experiments are ongoing, basically.
They all crashed. Our experiment is now ongoing. Right, let's face it. Ours is the one we're in. Let's pay attention to the one we're in. It's good to know about the others, but we need to bring the divine experiment that we are in now, which was originally conceived by divine beings in the galactic core, to its best conclusion, right? To its successful conclusion. And how are we going to do that? Well, the GNE is an attempt to answer that question.
What if we crash and fizzle with this experiment?
Well, all I can say is it's happened before, you know, and it's possible that it could happen. But there are many things at play upon the Earth and in the minds and hearts of human beings that could easily prevent that from happening. And so what I say to my team members or crew members in the Gaia Navigation Experiment is let's look at how we can turn this experiment around and prevent it from crashing, prevent humanity from destroying its own habitat, and how can we bring human potential into sanity and beauty so that we can really realize a harmonious society on this planet and live here as if it were a paradise, a natural paradise, which it is, of course.
What if we can't do that? What happens if we fail?
If we can't do that, she will take care of the mess and clean it up, and she'll start the experiment over again, which she's done many times before. So in the larger picture of things, if we fail to hold up our part, she will clean up the mess. She will compost a great part of humanity. She will extract that part of the human species which she considers, deems viable to go into another planetary experiment, and she will carry it forward. That's what she will ultimately do. But if I might speak for her for a moment, I would say that as far as I understand the mind of the Earth goddess, she would much prefer to correct the current experiment, and she would much prefer that some human beings join with her so we can correct it, because we are, after all, the subject of this experiment. So she wants it to succeed on our terms. She wants us to be part of the solution. But if we're not, and if we fail, and if we don't uphold our end, she'll just compost the whole thing and then do it over.
And that's a very high possibility, isn't it?
We're getting real close to that possibility, my friend. But we're also getting equally close to the possibility of what is called Sophia's correction. You see, in this mystery intel, which comes from the Coptic and Greek sources of the Nag Hammadi books discovered in English in 1945, I mean, principally from those sources, but also from a few others. In this intel, they say that the divine Sophia herself, that is the name for the living presence of the intelligence of the Earth, you know, that she would reach a point in this experiment when she would intervene to correct humanity's folly and insanity. And you could say that the surviving materials that I've studied, and other scholars as well, contain this clue. It's not so much a prediction of the future, but it's a clue of what possibly could happen in the future. Now, I believe we are in that moment that is designated by this term, correction, which is found in the Greek Coptic writing as the term diathesis. Yeah.
And do most experts in this arena, and there aren't too many, do they all believe this?
No, they don't believe anything like what I'm saying, and they don't even have a concept of what I'm saying, nor would they be able, probably, to comprehend what I just told you. And there's a reason for that is very clear. Those scholars, you know, there's a book. It's called The Nag Hammadi Library in English. Have you ever seen this book?
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it, of course.
Right. People cite it all the time, don't they?
Yes.
Well, of course they do. Because this book, which appeared in 1976 from a team of scholars in Claremont, California, led by James Robinson, was the definitive English translation of these Coptic and Greek writings that were found in Egypt in 1945, okay?
Were they astounded?
It's called the Nag Hammadi Library in English. There's a huge problem. This is the source material that I'm drawing from, but there's a huge problem with this source material and the people who translated it. First of all, they are scholars and historians of religion from the Judeo-Christian tradition. They have interpreted the mystery school teachings through the filter of Judeo-Christianity. Well, there's a big problem there, because the mystery school teachings were pre-Christian and in many respects anti-Christian and anti-Judaic. These Nag Hammadi writings are the writings of heretics, religious heretics, who were against the Christian belief system of salvation and the paternal Father God and the Messiah and the Apocalypse and all that. And so how is it possible that these scholars could have presented to the world a fair and accurate translation of these materials? They did not. I am the only scholar of the Nag Hammadi materials. And by the way, I was born on the week and probably the day these materials were discovered, if you like coincidences. I'm the only scholar who represents them from the point of view of the people who wrote them. And so when you represent and develop these source materials from the viewpoint of the pagan mystery school teachers and shamans, then you get the scenario that I am giving you now. But you're not going to find it from these other scholars who have their blinders on, their religious and ideological blinders.
Why don't they accept this?
I don't think they're interested in it, frankly, George. I think that the scholars, apart from myself, because I'm the only self-declared pagan, you know, John Lash is a pagan. What does that mean? You know, I'm the self-declared experimental mystic, you know. It's like, let's just give you a really stupid example. But suppose that someone gave you a manual on how to play golf, okay?
I'm not sure it would help me.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you play golf? I don't know, George.
Well, no, I used to hack a long time ago.
Right. But imagine someone gave you quite a technical manual on the ins and outs of golf with all golfing terms and diagrams, you know, and you didn't know what golf was. Wouldn't you be puzzled reading this manual?
I don't think I'd understand it if I didn't know what it was.
Right. The scholars, the religious scholars, the experts in the Coptic language who have translated these precious materials, which contain the very birthright of humanity, pointing us to our origins, our divine origins, are not mystics. I am a self-confessed mystic. So I can interpret material that is written by mystics and comes directly out of the intimate sanctuaries of the ancient mystical tradition, because I am myself a mystic. They can't interpret it, and I don't think they're interested. They're only interested in the Nag Hammadi writings as they kind of reflect on maybe various aspects of early Christianity.
Right. And are those writings very accurate, in your opinion?
Those writings are a bunch of gibberish and like the notes of some college student attending a professor's lectures who scribbled down various notions but didn't really totally even understand the lectures, but then in some places did understand them. The Nag Hammadi writings, as I've said before, and I stand by this, are written in a pseudo-language, which is Coptic, which is not a real language. It's like stenography.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, John, when we come back. Plus, we'll take phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.